Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last Wednesday was a day of horror across a wide swath of the South. A record number of tornadoes, hundreds, including true giants, churning across state after state, leaving terrible destruction. Hundreds dead in a day. Now the region is adding up the toll, beginning a huge job of cleanup and rebuilding. And many are still wondering what happened. This hour, On Point, the aftermath of last week's savage storms and the science of this onslaught of tornadoes. You can join the conversation. Did you witness the weather? What did you see? And what now? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's sound of the tornado coming through Tuscaloosa, Alabama, last Wednesday. You can hear people marveling, just little bits of voice in the background. We've all seen the video at this point. Enormous, enormous tornadoes. Joining me first today from Atlanta, Georgia, with the latest on the destruction and toll of last week's storms is CBS News correspondent Mark Strassman. Mark, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. We all know that the toll in death and those injured, those homeless, those still not found is very high, not to mention the enormous destruction of homes and infrastructure right across the South. Give us a sense of that scale. Can you put some numbers on it at this point, Mark? What the South has found itself surrounded by in the wake of this huge wave of storms?
Well, no question, Tom. This was a destruction that was one for the weather history books. We have not seen this sort of deadly tornado since 86 years, since 1925. So the latest numbers seem to be about, and think about how staggering some of these numbers are. And remember, too, that these numbers were all caused in one 24-hour period between 8 a.m. Wednesday of last week and 8 a.m. Thursday of last week. $5 billion in damages. 362 tornadoes in all, 340 people killed in one 24-hour period. I mean, that's just a staggering number. I've covered tornadoes for a long time, and typically they hopscotch from place to place, and you end up with, you know, a few people killed here and maybe a dozen people in all. And these numbers are just beyond belief. And, of course, the epicenter of it all was Alabama, where two-thirds of all the people killed died. And I spent several days in Tuscaloosa, one of the hardest-hit areas. And, you know, a college town like that, the home of the University of Alabama, the college town is known for its good times. Typically, they feel a little bit immune to the slings and arrows of the outside world. No more, not in Tuscaloosa, not after this terrible and devastating tornado.
A hurricane hits everything when it comes, everything along the coast. Tornadoes have paths. So what does that mean about the economic damage impact of this long term? These are kind of wide threads across the map, but they came, in this case, right through a number of densely settled areas. I mean, what kind of overall economic impact are we expecting here? Does it, for example, mean a real hit to the economy of the South, or is it more focused, more limited than that?
Well, the overall number is about $5 billion, although obviously that could change. And you're right that some of these twisters traveled far and wide. I mean, one twister traveled from Mississippi to North Carolina, a total of 380 miles, and it was an EF4 tornado, the second most severe kind. In some areas, the damage is intense, but fairly limited economically. That is, these were not necessarily economic bases. But at the same time, of course, the economic pain and the physical pain is intense when it's you and your family that's caught in the middle of it. So I think the long-term consequences are still a little bit unclear, but no question, in parts of the South that were already struggling economically, the last thing they needed was an EF5 tornado barreling through their neighborhood and chewing up the landscape.
President Obama came down. FEMA, of course, has been there from early on. What are they saying about disaster relief? Will there be federal funds released for rebuilding?
Short answer is yes. Alabama alone, 36 counties have been declared a federal disaster area. Of course, you know, ever since Katrina and all the hard hits that FEMA took for its response, the emergency response from Washington has been much swifter, much more efficient. There were far fewer complaints, for instance, in Tuscaloosa. Almost right away about the response. That is, people seemed to think that they were getting information, that help was on the way. There was a lot more confidence. And that is a huge change over Katrina, where I was 5 years ago. Whereas we all remember, there were just legions of complaints, many of them well-deserved, about how slow the response was and how sloppy the response was and how people sat around for weeks waiting for help that they needed.
We've seen the images of line crews and others streaming south to help here across state lines. More than a million people without power in Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee. At one point here, a lot of that from damage to transmitters at the Browns Ferry nuclear plant west of Huntsville, Alabama. What about the power situation at this point, Mark?
Much better. Only about 24,000 folks in Alabama, for instance, still without power. I mean, that's still a long time to be without power, but when you consider that, you're right, they started off in Alabama with perhaps as many as a million folks without power, that situation has improved dramatically. Other situations are still very much of a work in progress. They're still going through these rubbled neighborhoods, still looking for potentially victims of the storm. I mean, Tuscaloosa right now, the official death count, for instance, is around 38 or 39, but they believe that by the time it's all over, it'll be about 50 once the search and recovery crews, including cadaver dogs, go through all the neighborhoods that have been laid to waste, and they find perhaps every last victim of this devastating tornado.
And with buildings just torn to shreds, that's very difficult work, obviously. Some towns almost taken right off the map. Smithville, near Tupelo, essentially all the buildings gone. I mean, are we going to see some things erased from the map?
I think you will. I do. And I think even in neighborhoods, or in communities rather, that that are still standing, entire neighborhoods have been gone, which, for instance, was what Tuscaloosa's mayor said. I mean, entire neighborhoods are gone. And I was in three or four of these neighborhoods in Tuscaloosa, and I'm telling you, it is hard to find evidence that people would be able to salvage very much. I mean, occasionally you find a home here or there that wasn't nearly as badly damaged as the others, but for the most part, this was a scorched earth that this tornado left behind, and there are very little signs of hope. It is a complete rebuilding effort that would have to take place for these neighborhoods to come back.
Well, hope at least in those streaming in to help in that rebuilding, and we hope many, many more will do exactly that. Mark Strassman with CBS in Atlanta, Georgia. Thank you very much for joining us, Mark.
My pleasure.
I want to turn to Birmingham, Alabama now, and Chuck Fosh. He's chief of staff to Mayor William Bell there in the city of Birmingham. Chuck Fosh, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
How have you added up the destruction in your city? What are the numbers?
Well, the numbers, fortunately, for deaths are a few. We're at two confirmed fatalities, and we are hoping that that number still stands. About 1,000 homes or so have been destroyed, and countless businesses and families been put out. So right now we're holding strong.
I believe it was the same big tornado that hit Tuscaloosa that came through Birmingham as well. What, where did it hit the city, and where did it touch down, Chuck?
Well, it seemed like it took forever to get to Birmingham because we were able to watch as it came our way from Tuscaloosa. There were several areas that were very hard hit, Pratt City area, and I was listening just earlier about entire neighborhoods wiped out. This is a very historic neighborhood that is going to take a lot to rebuild. Smithville Estates, which is
mm-hmm.
which is right across and not far from us, Pleasant Grove area. So we've got a couple of areas, Sherman Heights, another neighborhood where the storm just decided to go where it wanted to go.
And funerals from the storm last week, are those going on now, Mr. Fosh?
Yes, sir. We've got, in fact, one of our firefighters' family, sister, funeral is today. So, yes, sir, unfortunately, we have some funerals.
Did you see the twister yourself, or were you down and sheltering? Did you catch sight of it?
On the television, I saw it. The mayor was also watching, and as was, I would imagine, a lot of folks seeing it come right our way and listening as it decided to go to the left or to the right.
What's it left you thinking about nature and your vulnerability there?
I think, obviously, you feel very, very human. And in that capacity, you realize you're, with all the things that we can do, you realize suddenly all the things that you cannot do. And so, obviously, nature is nature. And but we were very, very blessed in the regard that even though we had, we've got a lot to do here, and we've got a lot of devastation, but we feel very blessed that God allowed us to make it through.
We're glad it was not worse there in Birmingham. Right. Our condolences for those who lost their lives in your town, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, and we'll look forward to rebuilding.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound there of a tornado in Ringgold, Georgia, last Wednesday, a day of hundreds of tornadoes and fatalities in the South. We're looking at the aftermath of those savage storms this hour, the toll that they left behind, and the weather science behind what just happened. If you were there, you know just how wild it was. Here's Smithville, Mississippi resident James Cagle. He was pinned in the rubble of his own house during last week's tornado.
I heard a roar and a big bang in the front of the house, and I went to the back door to see, and I couldn't get out.
He couldn't get out, neither could many others, many still not found. Alabama resident Whitney Lawhorn lost family members during last week's tornadoes. Her aunt died first in a tornado, then a second tornado killed more of her family.
There was another one that came through later that day that got our great aunt and our great uncle. It's just like one big nightmare.
Families, neighborhoods, whole towns hit by enormous tornadoes. We're going to look at the science behind that. We'll hear in just a moment from Norman, Oklahoma, and the big severe storms laboratory there. Harold Brooks will join us from Oklahoma. Right now, Tom Grazulis is with us from St. Johnsbury, Vermont, meteorologist, tornado climatologist, author of The Tornado, Nature's Ultimate Windstorm. Tom, thank you very much for being with us. Put this in some historical perspective for us, Tom, this incredible onslaught we've seen in April and just last week. How's it rank?
Well, it's pretty difficult to compare one outbreak to another because they're so different. And prior to 1950, we really don't have very good information. The only thing we can compare it to in the official data period would be April 3rd of 1974. And when that occurred, we had 148 tornadoes in one day, 315 deaths. When that occurred, one of the questions that came up was, how often does something like this occur? We only had 20 years of data at the time.
Right.
And that really spurred my interest, and I've been working on it ever since, trying to come up with that answer.
We had 312 tornadoes in one 24-hour period last week.
We don't know whether that's happened before or not.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to 1950, no one was counting, particularly the small ones. If something went through a town and killed people and destroyed hundreds of homes, it made the record books and it made newspapers. But the smaller ones, which account for most of those hundreds, just weren't recorded at all.
Well, we'll talk about the science in a moment with Harold Brooks then, but what about the, you know very well, the narratives of big tornado strikes over time. You've seen the narrative of this one. It rolls out on radio and television every which way these days. I mean, just watching and listening, hearing the stories, seeing what you've seen, what previous storm eras does it take you back to?
Well, everyone's going to compare it to March 18th, 1925, where you had the tri-state tornado and 700 people killed, mostly across Illinois. But the one I look at is March 21st, 1932. You had at least 268 people dead in Alabama. And curiously enough, it was mentioned that Tuscaloosa seems immune to the slings and arrows of of these things. Well, if you look at the six, what I consider the six worst outbreaks of all time, Tuscaloosa has been part of three of them, Birmingham has been part of three of them. Alabama is the only state that's been part of all six. So there's a short memory going on here. The spacing between these huge outbreaks is just enough. It's like a generation between each one. And there's just enough spacing so that people forget. Like in 1932, there's a town just north of Tuscaloosa called Northport.
Mm-hmm.
Totally wiped out, 37 dead. And another one back in 1917, there were two killer tornadoes in Tuscaloosa County. Tuscaloosa County is extremely prone to tornadoes, but there's just enough space there. Tornadoes are rare events.
Sure. Well, especially
just enough space between them.
Mm-hmm.
So people forget. And the sirens, I mean, a lot of towns, the sirens aren't maintained, and there's just enough time between them to let the maintenance dissipate. And
sure, though we know, as a matter of record, that we do see these huge tornadoes, E4, E5, they are rare. What about the stories that illustrate the power of a tornado that big, Tom?
Well, some of the stories are pretty fascinating. People are more ready for them now, so some of the stories aren't quite as fascinating as they were in the past. And if you go back through 130 years, you can find some incredible descriptions.
Tell us.
Well, the first of the six outbreaks that I mentioned, you look back and there's just like no other. It goes back to February 1884, which included Birmingham, Alabama, but mostly across North Georgia. There was one calculation that I did. There must have been, at one time, 2,000 trees per second were being splintered and ripped out of the ground.
Whoa.
In some places, there was a 15-mile swath, up to 3 miles wide, of just trees totally leveled. There was only a few towns in that area, and those very, very small towns were completely wiped out. There's just nothing like some of the things that happened in North Georgia.
Trees,
in February of
1884. Toothpicks. Wow, along
and
such
then
a huge.
You get in Alabama. Yeah. There may have been 100 tornadoes alone in Alabama on March 21st, 1932. We really don't know. No one counted the small ones.
Well,
and one town after another, very, very small rural towns. We don't know that it was in the Depression. We don't know whether people were just buried and not even officially checked in.
We're counting now, and the destruction is pretty incredible. Tom Grazula, stand by there. We've got callers from the Tornado Zone, and I want to hear their stories. Jim is calling from Birmingham, Alabama. Jim, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air, sir.
Hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your experience, Jim?
My wife and I and a little baby, we live just outside of Birmingham, just to the northeast in a town called Pinson. This past Sunday, we actually were spared. We didn't lose power, no destruction, anything. But this past Sunday, we went to a town in St. Clair County, which is just to the east of Jefferson County, where Birmingham's located. And God blessed us enough to take some we were able to take some food and some supplies up to a part of Asheville, Alabama, which is the town we went to, that was completely destroyed. One street, the street we were on, 11 people died.
Wow.
While we were driving through, we saw the destruction, of course. We could tell the tornado was, probably about a mile wide that went through there, and it was just amazing. My question was, we saw, like I said, destruction and houses just completely demolished, people picking up, the pieces and everything, but there would be a house standing here and then three or four houses around it completely gone, and then a house standing here and then houses all around it completely gone. How does that happen? How does, you know, the tornado miss one house but completely destroy another right beside each other?
Jim, let us pick that up. And we have seen the pictures that you of what you saw firsthand, and it is astonishing. I mean, completely splintered houses right next to pretty intact structures. To begin to go in that direction, let me go to Norman, Oklahoma, and Harold Brooks. He's a research meteorologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Severe Storms Laboratory. Harold Brooks, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Tom.
This is very immediate science question, I guess, but you hear the people of the South asking. We've all seen it on television. These tornadoes are so large, their power is so almost unimaginably huge. How does one house get torn literally practically to toothpicks and one right next door or one standing in the middle of four or five destroyed stand intact? How does that happen?
Well, there are two things that take place. One of them is that the winds inside of the tornado are highly variable. And so it's possible that the house that survived actually didn't see as much wind as the one around it. And the other thing is that frequently houses are built just a little bit differently. And once one part of your house starts to fail, if the roof starts to come off, the rest of the house typically fails very quickly. And so perhaps maybe the roof wasn't attached as well, or the walls weren't as attached as well to the foundation. So there's lots of things, both meteorological and non-meteorological, that go on to lead to that kind of pattern.
And you're saying, so if we could X-ray the wind within that funnel, or many of these looked much bigger than what you'd ever call a funnel, that column, you'd see a patchwork of different wind speeds and pressures even within the tornado itself?
Oh, certainly. There have been some detailed Doppler radar studies of tornadoes up close that reveal small vortices inside of the tornado where the highest winds take place, and that, well, relative calm is perhaps an understatement, but that much weaker winds close by to it. And if you are unlucky and get hit by one of those multiple vortex aspects, you can run into bigger trouble.
Let's get another example maybe of this. Kia in Birmingham, Alabama. Kia, thank you very much for calling.
Hi, Tom. I got to witness the storm. I actually live, my neighborhood borders Pleasant Grove and Pratt City and some of the other neighborhoods here in western Jefferson County. And, you know, we watched the storm come, you know, from Tuscaloosa. And when it crossed over into Jefferson County, I told my husband, we have to go. We can't stay. We can't wait. And, I mean, just as it was hitting Pleasant Grove, I mean, I did a silly thing, which is I got in my car and we left. We fled for, you know, the mountain just to get out of harm's way, and you know, fortunately our house was spared, our neighborhood was spared, but got to go into Pratt City and see the devastation firsthand, and you know, it's incredible. I mean, it's just, I've never seen anything like it. I'm originally from Buffalo. We have blizzards, not tornadoes.
Right. But here, not just houses down, but many, many lives lost, Kia.
That's exactly right. I think I'm still trying to recover from it, just trying to get my mind around what happened to our city, our cities, you know, what happened to Birmingham and Tuscaloosa.
We wish you luck there with rebuilding, and thank you for calling. Let me get one more. Cumberland, Mississippi, and Michael. Michael, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Of course, you know, we had the one come through here that went on to Tuscaloosa, and I've seen a lot of tornadoes, but I've never seen anything like this. The gentleman that was describing the trees literally ripped in half.
Yep.
I guess these I saw a whole forest decapitated at about the 10-foot level. Now, why the 10-foot level, I don't know. But these are huge trees with different girths.
Sheared off.
What was surprising was the field around them was completely, there wasn't a twig or a leaf left in those fields that were around them. There wasn't any debris. It was completely hoovered with a vacuum cleaner. There wasn't even ants left in the anthill.
Yeah.
That's how clean the field was, and that was next to it. But what my question is more has to do with the science. There is a lowering of the jet airstream that seems to be the culprit of bringing in the a cold airstream, jet airstream coming down and meeting our southern warm air coming up off the Gulf.
Right.
And wherever those two collide tends to be the problem area. And it could be anywhere from 5 miles in from the Gulf all the way up to Kentucky or beyond.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering, we just had a month of severe huge forest fires out in Texas.
Yes.
And I'm just thinking, these are atmospherics. Energy, when you burn a fire, the energy of that fire is never really lost, dissipated perhaps, but that energy goes somewhere. And I'm just wondering if this has probably never been documented. Nobody's tracking this, but I'm wondering if these fires, these huge fires that go on for a month, could be a contributing factor to the violence of this storm.
Michael, let us pick it up, and thank you for your call from Cumberland, Mississippi. Harold Brooks, we want to follow this trail on the atmospherics just as far as we can here today, but let's just start with the fundamentals of what was going on atmospherically in your analysis that contributed to this huge number of tornadoes, such strong ones. And what about Michael's question about, you know, could you have forest fires so big that the heat from the energy from those fires would contribute to a tornado spree?
Well, when we look for tornadoes, we're looking for a set of basic ingredients. We want to have warm, moist air at the low levels, and we want to have relatively dry, relatively cold air above that. And we also are looking for the right kind of wind profile in the atmosphere. Typically, the wind's blowing wherever you are on the planet, blowing from the equator at low levels and then blowing from the west aloft. And when those ingredients come together, we're more likely to produce the kind of storms that can make tornadoes. Now, during the month of April, we've been in a pattern that is relatively rare to get stuck in this pattern, where there's a trough in the upper atmosphere where, as Michael mentioned, the jet stream comes down south. Where that's sort of the bottom of that trough is over sort of the central U.S., maybe Texas, New Mexico, and that usually that kind of a pattern moves fairly quickly. And in this case, it's stayed in somewhat the same place, and we've had smaller waves that have come out from that have led to that have been associated with the tornado outbreaks. Now, the forest fires and the grass fires are really unlikely to contribute a significant amount of energy for anything like the thunderstorm formation in the east. Now,
because they're simply not big enough, as big as they are?
They're really not. I mean, the amount of energy that takes place inside of a single thunderstorm per second, the energy transformation is, you know, we're talking atomic bombs per second. And so it's a huge amount of energy just from the evaporation and condensation of water inside the storm. So the forest fires aren't that big in that comparison. But the pattern that led to the persistent storminess in the east is the same large-scale pattern that's associated with it being dry in Texas and in the western half of Oklahoma. And so they're related to the same large-scale pattern, but it's really not a cause-effect between one and the other.
And, of course, this all very much related to the Gulf of Mexico, surely, and the warmth off the Gulf and moisture, as you say.
The Gulf of Mexico is one of the reasons that the central part of the United States and eastern United States is so prone to tornadoes. That's where the energy source is, the warm, moist air. And what happened for most of April was that typically when these storm systems come east out of the central U.S. through the eastern U.S., the cold front that's associated with them will frequently penetrate into the Gulf of Mexico and essentially cuts off that flow of warm, moist air. Well, until over the weekend, in the aftermath of the outbreak, we didn't have one of those cold fronts go through, and so the warm moisture was in place the whole time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big, big wave of big, big tornadoes in the South last week. The aftermath, the toll of all that, and the weather science, maybe the climate science behind it. Harold Brooks is with us from Norman, Oklahoma, right there at the heart of the nation's National Severe Storms Laboratory. Tom Grazulas is with us. He's followed tornado and tornado history for a long time, author of Significant Tornadoes 1680 to 1991 and The Tornado. Here was Rachel Mulder in Duncanville, Alabama. She survived Wednesday's tornado, riding it out in the bathtub with her husband, says she's lucky to be alive.
Blessed by the grace of God, we were saved. I mean, the hand of God watched over us, and we were spared in that bathtub. I feel very blessed.
They were spared. Many were not. Here's Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour saying last week's tornadoes didn't behave as people are accustomed to.
It seemed as if where we are accustomed to a big tornado striking and then playing itself out in most occasions, that many of these big supercells got stronger and stronger.
supercells. We're going to look at that, the weather, the climate. Rick in Harrisonburg, Virginia, thanks for calling, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I just happened to take a trip in my truck, basically paralleling the line of the storms coming down from Virginia and going to Texas. The first place I saw damage was in a town called Glade Springs, and I'd never seen tornado damage before, but it was just staggering. There were tractor trailers that were thrown 100 yards into the woods and things like that, and the woods were gone. What really is amazing about it is when you watch something on TV, you just get a picture that's a square.
Yep.
But when you're in a tornado damage zone, it's all around you, and it's like a bomb went off. The next place I hit was a town called Trenton, Georgia, which I haven't heard anything much about Trenton, but I saw the damage, and I actually drove my truck on the way back. I stopped and drove on the way back and toured that town, and some of the houses were scoured right to the foundation. There was just nothing left, and through it all, I noticed that there was an amazing ability of America to respond to these things that I don't know if other countries really have it. There were crews that came from all over the country. They were getting the juice turned back on. There were disaster recovery teams. There were telephone people and insurance people. And it's an amazing ability that we have in this country.
Rick, those are heartening stories of that response, and I appreciate your eyewitness accounts as well of what you've seen. They're like a bomb going off. Stay safe in your truck there, Rick. Let's go to Tullahoma, Tennessee, and Volley. Volley, thank you for calling.
Hello, how are you?
Pretty well. What have you seen?
Well, something that I have never seen in my life is, when we have tornadoes down here a lot, I live in Tullahoma, Tennessee, which is quite a distance from some of the major tornadoes, and we're finding photographs, insulation. Somebody found a marriage certificate. It's really easy to find tornado debris that just fell out of the sky. I found a photograph from Hackleburg, Alabama, which is at least about 80 miles from us. And then yesterday I found a photo from Jasper, Alabama, which is 158 or so miles from us.
Wow.
So just and there's bank statements from Huntsville and everything else, but I've never seen anything like this where you could pick up debris this far away from the tornado maybe the air was colder over our town and it dropped. I don't know what happened.
It sounds like a tall tale, Volley, but we believe it from the photos we've seen. People's personal effects just scattered all over an enormous region. Thank you for that call. And one more, Adrian in Birmingham, Alabama. Adrian, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I live in Fultonville, which is just a little north of Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like the guy in the truck was talking about. We were watching the TV and just kind of getting hypnotized by what we were seeing on the TV. We realized how huge it was. As they're saying, we've never seen anything like this in our lives. And so we got under the house, my family and I did. And I have never been scared like that before. It was really, really frightening. And I was in Mississippi during Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
It was not like this. It was, I heard the train noise. I've never heard that noise. Never seen a tornado in my life. It was wild. But the guy that was before me just now, he kind of took my question. I wanted to know about, because pill bottles were falling out of this guy, with Tuscaloosa addresses on them. How does that happen?
Just how far all this goes. Let us pick it up. And I appreciate your call as well, Adrian. Harold Brooks, speak to us about the power of these storms to destroy, lift, and transport everything that we're seeing here. Little pieces of people's lives scattered all over the region. Explain it to us.
Well, strong tornadoes have a lot of horizontal wind, but they also have near the ground a lot of very strong upward motion. And so when a house is hit, and papers particularly can get lifted to maybe tens of thousands of feet high inside of the storm and then carried along, and essentially they fall out when they're outside of the main tornadic circulation, and they'll still fall for a long distance. There have been reports in previous tornadoes of checks, for instance, being carried on the order of 300 miles. Checks tend to be something that are easy to track where they came from, so they're one of the primary things you can look for in debris lofting. Larger objects you know, books can get thrown, you know, maybe 10, 20 miles,
wow,
perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And there was from a tornado in the 1980s in Wisconsin, there was a truck bumper that was thrown about 5 miles, supposedly.
That's a long way for something dense and heavy. Haley Barbour, the governor there, talked about supercells that would usually dissipate but did not seem to this time. What's a supercell? What's their duration? How do they figure into tornado creation?
Well, supercells are thunderstorms that are essentially rotating throughout the depth of the storm. And they're the kind of storm that makes the most devastating tornadoes, the largest hail, and almost all of them are associated with some kind of severe weather. And in fact, that's really at the beginning of the forecasting process. What we're basically forecasting is the presence of supercell thunderstorms. They tend to last for a few hours. An ordinary thunderstorm may only last for 30 minutes. But they can go supercells maybe a few hours up to 7 or 8 hours. We had in the case of this week, we had the supercell that produced tornadoes from Mississippi all the way into North Carolina and was apparently producing tornadoes for on the order of 7 to 8 hours. So they're essentially the most dangerous kind of thunderstorm we have, it takes a certain kind of special conditions for them to occur.
When you look at the architecture of the weather that produced these storms, can you tie it to global climate change? I mean, we've seen warning after warning that we may see an increase in severe storm conditions on the planet because of climate change. I saw one in 2008, the U.S. Global Change and Research Program came out with a report. This is from the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, saying more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere could increase severe storms. Now, is that related to supercell creation? Is that related to tornado creation?
Well, the planet has undoubtedly warmed over the last 50 years to 100 years, and it will undoubtedly continue to warm as greenhouse gases play a bigger role. It's not really clear what the connection is with tornadoes in particular. Some of the ingredients we look for the production of supercell storms, such as the warm, moist air at low levels, are going to increase in intensity and frequency of being supportive of supercell storms. But on the other hand, one of the main predictions of climate change is that the equator to pole temperature difference will decrease because the poles will warm more than the equator. And that's related to the change of the winds with height term, which is one of the things that helps organize storms and helps make them more likely to produce tornadoes. That's predicted to be lessening as we go along. And so we've got some ingredients that are increasing in intensity and others that have been decreasing. And if we look historically in the record and we attempt to make some adjustments over the last, say, 50 or 60 years for what we know as changes in reporting, we really see no correlation between tornado occurrence and intensity and the global temperature, or even the U.S. national temperature.
So even when you see these big numbers, Tom Grazulis reminds us that we just don't know what happened, you know, 500 years ago on tornadoes, or 600 years ago, or further back. When you look at these big numbers, as a scientist who's also living on this planet and sharing this climate, are you wondering if there's a correlation, or you're thinking that over time even climate change itself may diminish ultimately tornado creation?
Well, with tornadoes, it's a really very difficult thing to say. I think there's some evidence to suggest that hail has shifted slightly in the intensity distribution, the size distribution of hail. There's some observations from France and Italy in particular that suggest that to be true as well. But at the same time, perhaps a slight decrease in the overall occurrence of hail as the surface has warmed, the layer over which hail can melt has gotten deeper, and so we only see the biggest hail falling out of that. Now, the impacts of that are fairly small and may take a long time to be able to see in statistics in this country, but the tornado distribution, since tornado depend more upon the changes of the wind with height than even hail does, it's really hard to tell. And one of the things that events like last week are very rare events. In terms of comparable events, 1974 comes up. The 1932, 1884 come up as sort of these really big kind of events. And so it's very hard to use them as indicators of anything. When we look over look at all of the tornadoes that are at least of F1 intensity over the last 50 or 60 years, the trend in that has been essentially negligible over that time period.
And what about severe storms generally? You don't just look at tornadoes. What about the trend in severe storms? I think a lot of people have the sense that we are seeing more severe weather around us. What do you come down on that?
Well, like I said, hail, there's at least some indication that we're seeing some things. When in the United States, we define severe thunderstorms as being tornado, wind, and hail. And there's some evidence for hail slightly increasing. the largest size. In the future, I think that the research indicates is most supportive of perhaps an increase in non-tornadic windstorms. It's hard to tell in the records. One of the things that's very unfortunate is the way that we collect our reports of severe thunderstorms. You really can't use the reporting database to say anything about what's happened in the past. It's our records just have, our record keeping has changed over the years. Now, one of the things that we have somewhat more confidence in changing is the frequency of heavy rain, which for reasons that we don't need to go into is officially not severe in the United States, but that a shift towards the heaviest rainfalls being part of becoming heavier is something that's a fairly safe prediction to make out of global climate change research.
And you say not official, but everybody there near that border of Kentucky, Illinois, and Missouri is looking today where the levees are being blown to relieve pressure on the levee surrounded Cairo and all that farmland being inundated in order to take that pressure off in the Ohio. That's a lot of rain that's come down to create that.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not saying that those events aren't bad. Officially, we don't count them as severe in the United States, like I said, for reasons that we don't need to go into. And in fact, historically, I think that this year, the analog year that I look at for this year in the past is probably 1927. It was April of 1927 was a big tornado month. It didn't have the single big outbreak like we had last week. But 1927 is also that's the year of the flood of record on the southern Mississippi River below Cairo, where in fact they blew levees south of New Orleans to protect the city of New Orleans from flooding. And that was a huge flood year, and it's very difficult to actually have a major flood on the southern Mississippi given the size of the river. So I think that's a year that we look back on and that looks perhaps somewhat similar to this. But one of the issues when we're dealing with these kinds of things where our record keeping changes over time is that it's really hard to tell how much of any change is really physical change and how much is the record-keeping changes.
Tom Grizulis, you followed this over centuries when it comes to significant tornadoes. Do you have a gut sense? I think an awful lot of people fear that we're in the midst of much more severe weather, and when people's houses are blown up or floated away, they have reason to wonder. How do you look at it? I mean, you're not a climate scientist, but you've watched weather over a long, long time.
When you look at the record, there is some evidence of a decrease in the number of intense tornadoes. But what happens in the atmosphere is two things are happening, really. One is that there's a normality in the atmosphere that's very strange. About once every 20 or 40 years, you get perfect conditions, and you get these phenomenal outbreaks. And when you combine that with the fact that you're getting more and more valuable property and more population, more homes, more buildings, more developments, when you get every single time you get one of these incredible events, these perfect tornado conditions, you get more damage, and you get more deaths, more injuries, more, despite the effort of all the weather services.
Sure.
They're doing a wonderful job. You get this huge increasing damage that's more and more each time.
So our sense of...
It's extremely hard to everyone assumes right away that things are getting worse. And they may not be. It just may be we've got more to damage.
Of course, they may not be. They may be. Ted in Cullman, Alabama. Ted, our time is short, but you're on the air.
I was just listening, and I agree with his point to an extent, but I just went through something I never went through here in my life. I'm 11 years in Alabama from the Northeast. It seems in the past 5 years that the your normal rain and your normal heat is gotten worse in the last. Everybody down here will tell you that. I keep asking the same question to them. A lot of them think that might have something to do with El Nino and the oceans and the.
Yeah, Ted, you're breaking up a little on us there, but I appreciate your call. La Nina, currents in the Pacific, Harold Brooks, how they factor in, and what about the warming of the seas in general? That would seem to give off energy that could be involved here, Harold.
Well, La Nina is at least a factor potentially in increasing tornado outbreaks in the eastern part of the United States. We have a weakening La Nina right now, and several of our big outbreaks have occurred during La Nina years. As I mentioned, the water vapor is one of the ingredients to produce severe thunderstorms. But as we talked about with energy processes earlier, the tornado is actually a very, very small part of energetically of a thunderstorm. It's not even completely clear why tornadoes exist. We know that the thing that thunderstorms do is they take warm and moisten the upper atmosphere and cool and dry the lower part of the atmosphere. And so we don't really know what the purpose of a tornado is, but it's actually not a very big part energetically of the thunderstorm.
But it's spinning like a top when you get those different air masses meeting. We've heard about Arctic air actually leaking out of the polar regions because related to climate change. Could that be a factor, Harold?
Probably not. The cold air that's associated that we really care about for severe thunderstorms is the air aloft that usually comes from over the Rocky Mountains.
And so it comes. It has come. It has spun so many in this last week and in this last month. 600 tornadoes in April, and everybody's still trying to get a handle on how that could happen and what that means. For all those listening to us today in the South and dealing with the cleanup, we wish you the best with that, and we hope to see a lot of helping hands coming your way. Tom Grzulis in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, I want to thank you for being with us today. Thank you so much for your insights.
You're welcome.
And Harold Brooks at the National Severe Storms Laboratory in Norman, Oklahoma. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Brooks.
You're welcome.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.